The next case is 05-400, State of Ohio versus Michael A. Lather.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is John Colasar from the Sandusky County Prosecutor's Office. I'm representing the state of Ohio today. Also with me is Mr. Crawford from the Attorney General's Office, who will be using 5 minutes of our time. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court today, Your Honor, is whether an arresting officer is required to receive acknowledgement of a defendant's actual understanding of his Miranda rights after asking the Miranda question. It's undisputed here that Detective Wolf actually did ask the defendant about his rights and then proceeded during a search warrant to later ask him some questions regarding some items that were found. Today, we're asking the court to reverse the Sixth District's decision, which overturned the appellee's conviction of drug trafficking, a first-degree felony, and establish a clear rule regarding the standard that the lower court should follow for finding a knowing and intelligent implied waiver of Miranda. There are three things that we think are wrong or error from the Sixth District, and I'm going to go over those three things. First of all, we feel that the Sixth District failed to give due regard to the findings of the trial court. The proper deference would have been to only disregard those findings if they were deemed to be clearly erroneous. In this case, the Sixth District actually cited to several of the findings, and implicitly, the trial court's findings here indicated that the defendant actually did have an understanding of his rights. This case involves two statements that the defendant made. The first statement was made on August 17th. During that statement, the same detective, as was involved at the search warrant on August 31st, had Mirandized the defendant. And the court found that waiver was knowing and intelligent. Therefore, the defendant had the understanding. Then on the 31st, he made the statements during the search warrant. We also feel that the Sixth District applied the rule of Teague improperly. We think that Teague is a good rule, but the difference between this case and Teague is that in Teague, the state presented absolutely no evidence. There was nothing in the record to indicate that the defendant in that case had any understanding or even had the capability of understanding what his rights were after they were read to him.
How do we write your proposition of law indicates, it seems, almost a totality of the circumstances test, although I thought you were arguing also that the Court of Appeals has established a per se rule that which is which. I mean, if you think the Court of Appeals adopted a per se rule, that's a legal issue that we should decide. But if the Court of Appeals simply applied Teague and the general law and decided that here you could not tell in the August 31st advice to the defendant whether he understood the advice or not, that we have a different issue, do we not? One would be the Court of Appeals applied the law just incorrectly. The other would be you're asking us to review a new proposition of law that the Court of Appeals had decided. Which is it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the only way to interpret the Sixth District's holding and decision is that they did, in fact, apply a per se rule. The factors indicated that there was actual understanding by the defendant. The only the only thing that they rested their decision on, citing to this court's decision in Murphy, is that there was not that request for acknowledgement by the officer.
How about their final statement? It's over an order for appellant to minimum imply that he waived his Miranda rights. It must be shown that he understood those rights. Such an understanding may not be presumed. Accordingly, find appellants for that's the general law, isn't it? Don't we want? I mean, the law says that the defendant has to understand what the Miranda rights mean to him or her. That's basic law, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the law.
That's the Court of Appeals' final word before they dispose of the case.
Right, but before that, they cite to State versus Murphy, stating where a suspect speaks freely to police after acknowledging that he understands his rights, a court may infer the suspect implicitly waived his rights.
Oh, and sure, that was the fact of the case. I mean, the defendant spoke afterwards and showed that he understood, but that's not exclusive, is it? The Court of Appeals didn't say that's the only way in which Miranda can be met, did it?
I believe that if you read the decision, that's the only conclusion you can come to.
Counsel, are you saying that the only conclusion you can come to is that the defendant has to verbally acknowledge an understanding of the Miranda waiver?
I think that's what the court, the Sixth District, has said in its opinion.
Okay, and you're saying that depending on the circumstance, there are other indicators of understanding, and that verbal is just one.
Justice O'Connor, I believe that I would agree with your statement, yes, that there are factors, the totality of the circumstances, which were set forth in North Carolina versus Butler, and I know that case dealt with a waiver of Sixth Amendment, but all along courts have cited North Carolina versus Butler, and these cases kind of overlap because they all deal with the Miranda issue.
Counsel, at the suppression hearing, the same officer gave the rights on the 17th of August and then the 31st, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I was going to get to the factors that we think show that there was actual understanding, which we think is the proper standard, not whether or not there was a question and answer by the officer, do you understand these rights, and then an affirmative answer. That wouldn't get a reviewing court nowhere. You still must look at the totality of the circumstances whenever you have the issue of waiver.
But in the first questioning, he did do that, as I understand. He asked the question, do you understand, and the defendant did say yes, correct?
Yes. In the first encounter on August 17th, Detective Wolf was the interviewing officer, and that was at a station house. That was a station house interview, which is a little bit different than the August 31st. But in that instance, there was a form given to the defendant, read to the defendant. He signed the form indicating his waiver and his understanding, and then a conversation took place.
And then it sounds like on the 31st, he took a shortcut and didn't go through all of the questions and answers that he did the first time. Is that right?
I think on the 31st, since it was a search warrant, the officer handcuffed him, placed him in the vicinity, I think it was right outside his apartment door while they were conducting the search, and was not intending to interrogate him. Then he moved on, and another officer came up as they found some items, which were digital scales. He then asked him some questions about those digital scales. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, there was some conversation from the defendant. And I think once you get past the understanding, there is a second issue of what actions were taken or were present that indicated that there was a waiver. And that has to be also looked at with the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, the two circumstances we're pointing to are Lather's questioning to the officers about another person who was there who had a mask on. He asked about that. And also, the actual statement that he made on the 31st was regarding the scales, and it was to some degree exculpatory, excusing that they were there, they had belonged to the previous renters, and that they did not work. I would like to reserve the balance of my time at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Colasar. Mr. Crawford.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Chief Justice Moyer, if I could, I'd like to address your concern over whether or not the Sixth District in this case, in fact, created a per se rule. And I think they did. And the clearest indicator in my view of that is look at the differentiating treatment that they gave to the two sets of statements in this case. On August 17th, Mr. Lather made one set of statements, and then on August 31st, he made another. The Sixth District said that the first set of statements were admissible, the second were not. And the only reason it gave for differentiating between those two situations is whether or not someone asked Mr. Lather whether he understood those rights.
What would be the reason for giving someone Miranda rights if you didn't know whether they understood them?
Well,
the best way to know whether they understood them is to ask them.
Well, I think that's one way, but I think the U.S. Supreme Court, especially in the Butler case, made it quite clear that the focus needs to be on the substance of what a defendant in fact knew and not the specific words that were said or the questions that were asked. And I think the Miranda warnings themselves, the court has been quite clear in saying that those serve the purpose of warning an individual and kind of awakening them to their rights and awakening the police officers to understand the interrogation is about to begin. And it's not clear that adding an additional layer to the Miranda script, so to speak, by requiring police officers to ask whether someone understands their rights adds anything to that analysis. And I think in that respect, it's quite similar to the Butler case, where the court considered whether requiring an express statement of waiver was necessary under Miranda. And I believe the court made it clear that in those situations, those don't speak to the concerns that the Miranda warnings and the Miranda rights themselves were geared towards protecting. And I think the same can be said of whether or not someone understands their rights. There could always be followed by equivocal answers, which, again, it gets the focus on what was said and not, in fact, what the defendant knew.
Well, are you saying then once a defendant expresses the fact that he understands Miranda, that question need not be asked later on at a different point in time?
Well, I think it can go, Justice Lansinger, I think it can go to show that perhaps at later in time that they do understand their rights. I mean, showing an understanding before and having a past experience being Mirandized and waiving your rights can certainly inform a later decision about whether or not that individual did the same. Are you speaking, I guess, in terms of staleness of someone's statement that they understand their rights?
I mean, it's as I said earlier, it sounds as though the officer did a shortcut the second time through. And he knows that he talked to him 2 weeks earlier. He said, "Do you understand Miranda?" The answer was yes. The second time through, though, he repeats the Miranda without asking, "Do you understand?" So it seems like it's a matter of a technical defect. Now, the question is, should that technical defect cause the evidence to be suppressed in the second questioning?
Well, Justice Lansinger, I guess first I would say I don't think it's a defect that he didn't ask him the second time whether he understood his rights. I don't think it's a requirement at all that a police officer ask someone whether they understand their rights. The requirement is the warning, and then for the state later to prove that someone, in fact, understood their rights. And I think as long as the state can present evidence to show that, regardless of whether an officer asks or whether someone understands those rights, that's sufficient for a Miranda warning.
You don't have the practice that when Miranda rights are given after every statement, you have the right to remain silent, do you understand? There's no question with respect to whether the person understands or not. You don't wait for an answer when you give those rights?
Well, I can't speak to the practice of the various police departments, but I certainly don't think there's anything in the court's jurisprudence, Miranda jurisprudence, that requires that sort of statement. And I see my time's expired, so I'd like to reserve the balance of the time for Mr. Colazar. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Mr. Sandwich.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice and all the other members of the court, my name's Michael Sandwich. I represent the defendant, Michael Lather. I respectfully disagree with what the court has been told here today in terms of the positions that the state are attempting to represent and move before the court. I obviously realize they're making that argument in their briefs and what they've verbally done here today. But this case is about inferences and implications tenfold times over when you look at all the details. When you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, they say they want this court to review the per se rule that's established. The plain reading of that Court of Appeals decisions is that they made their decision based on the law as it currently exists and the totality of the circumstances. They want this honorable court to make inferences regarding that. What this case is really about is if you were to make the ruling in the favor of the state as they've requested, you will be establishing an area of new law regarding Miranda that has not been done by any court in this country, not another state, nor the U.S. Supreme Court. If you were to support their position, you were going to be making a new law that says they can both imply an understanding of the Mirandas, and they can also imply a waiver of Miranda. And that there's no court in this land that's ever made that finding.
Mr. Sandwich, do you have to ask, should the police, or is the police required to ask, do you understand every time the Miranda warnings are given?
I believe they should be, Your Honor. However, the law does not require them to do that. The totality of the circumstances does allow you to look to other things. Even the state makes a reference in their brief, though, that it is such a simple procedure that it ought to be done in every case.
What does the totality of circumstances show in this case, Mr. Sandwich?
Your Honor, I believe they support Tagg versus Louisiana, point by point. Tagg versus Louisiana says, first of all, you cannot presume that Miranda rights were understood by the defendant. What happened in this case, first of all, there's been some, I believe, perhaps honest misstatements of the facts. One officer read the Miranda rights on both occasions.
Yes.
But one officer did not question, the same officer did not question on both occasions. Two totally different officers, Your Honor. But what the facts in this case are is that in the first incident on August 17th, it was a police station type of interrogation, and it's disputed within the motion to suppress transcript as to what occurred that day. The trial judge, as you all know from his opinion, indicated that Miranda was not needed to be re-advised. He didn't find that Miranda had been given on the second occasion. He did not find that my client understood it, and he did not find that my client waived it. The Court of Appeals went through all the analysis that's required by the law, but what occurred, the difference in the factual differences, in the police interrogation on the 17th, a form was provided to my client that he signed. The officers did not indicate that he went through each one verbally and asked each one. He indicated that he provided the form. My client testified, and that's a very important part that I want to make the court aware of. There's a lot of inferences drawn in the briefs of the state that because certain things weren't said by my client, that somehow inferences can be made. There was a stipulation entered into between the state and the defendant at the suppression hearing, and it's found at transcript page 47 of the supplement, that he was only going to testify about the August 17th date. The state agreed that that's all it would be. The court agreed to the stipulation, and further, that it couldn't be used by the state in its case in chief. And to now turn it around and attempt to utilize it by negative inference, I think, is improper.
In fact, the trial court found that they didn't even need to give him a second Miranda warning, and that required the Court of Appeals then to do their own totality analysis, since the court had not done it at all by finding it wasn't even necessary.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals was the only court that has made a total review of the whole case for this court's consideration. And as it's already been pointed out, if that's all this court is doing is reviewing the Court of Appeals, that's improper.
So it'd be hard to even make an abuse of discretion argument because the trial court didn't even exercise discretion.
Absolutely not. And what's more important, to follow up on the prior question, in terms of what happened, in terms of the totality of the circumstances, there was nothing that was done. Both officers testified that they did nothing to independently verify that he did anything to waive or understand his rights. On the August 17th date, it's the form by itself. On the August 31st date, there is nothing. And that specifically, it's referenced in my brief where you can find the pages in the transcript. They both acknowledge that. In fact, the Court of Appeals makes specific point of that at page 10 of their opinion, that when the second officer who does the questioning and the actual interrogation, they review his totality of circumstances, and they find that he acknowledges that, one, he didn't read the Mirandas at all, two, he didn't ask my client whether he understood them or waived them, and he specifically said, I did nothing else to independently verify. So even though the trial court then later questions and asks my client about his education and some of his life experiences, the two officers didn't do that on the day when he was being questioned.
But on the 31st, didn't Wolf Mirandize him?
Yes, Your Honor. Detective Wolf Mirandized,
but it was Garza who questioned him.
No, it was an officer by the name of St. Clair that got the incriminating statements. And Detective Wolf and St. Clair weren't together at any point in time. All of this occurred in a flowing manner. When my client was actually stopped at a traffic stop by Officer Garza. Then, at some point in time, Detective Wolf Mirandizes him, puts him in cuffs, and I believe the evidence would show, takes him up to the top of the staircase, puts him in a chair, and sits there while they're doing the search of the apartment. At some point in time, the officers are all doing their own things, and Detective Sinclair of the Ottawa County Sheriff's Department does the questioning, not in the presence of Detective Wolf. And it's also important to note.
But you could realistically, looking at these facts, looking at his education, looking at the times he'd been arrested, looking at the fact that he had 2 weeks prior just been Mirandized and said he understood, you could reach the conclusion that he also understood here, but that would simply be us disagreeing with the appellate court on an abuse of discretion standard if we were to make that conclusion, would it not?
Right.
And there's no real law, it's just we differ on opinion.
Right, because the Court of Appeals applied a totality of the circumstances case. There is no per se stated in there, and to attempt to read between the lines the way the state requests requires a lot of vivid imagination, in my opinion.
Counsel, do you think it's an abuse of discretion to say that on the 17th he understood what the waiver entailed, and 10 days later, or maybe not even that, he didn't?
Well, first of all, I believe the evidence would show in the transcripts that a form was placed in front of him, and there was a discrepancy between the detective testifying and my client, who testified at the suppression hearing, as to what the form supposedly meant when he was being presented.
It was a Miranda waiver form.
Correct.
Everybody agrees with that.
And
everybody
Miranda
agrees
waiver
he
form.
Signed it.
Well, let me back up. I think for purposes of legal analysis, looking at it, reading it, it is a Miranda waiver form. My client, though, testified during the suppression hearing that while he was in the booking station, he was being given lots of forms to sign, that the detective told him, just sign these, Mike. You're going to go to jail. We're going to collect property. And that he wasn't being, my client's version at the suppression hearing, was that he wasn't being told this specific form was for the specific purpose of waiving Miranda.
And I understand that, but the finding was that he was appropriately Mirandized and waived his Miranda rights on the 17th.
The implication, and here we go to implying again, that you cannot look at the trial court's finding and find a place which says exactly what you just said. You have to make an implication to find that.
The trial court did not set aside or invalidate the warning that was waived on the 17th.
No, it did
so
not.
The inference is, and it's a reasonable inference, that was a valid Miranda experience for the client. Okay. And given that was a valid Miranda experience, 10 days or 12 days later,
14,
whatever, 2 weeks, is it unreasonable to think that he forgot that valid Miranda experience?
Well,
is that an abuse of discretion?
I believe it is. I believe the law, as laid down by the U.S. Supreme Court and this court as well, is clear that you do a totality of the circumstances, and it's a case-by-case finding. Because I don't think there's a law that says...
What circumstances are we talking about? Maybe that's at the crux here. What circumstances are we talking about that encompass the totality? Can we go back 2 weeks, and that's part of the totality of the circumstances? Or are you just looking on the day of the 31st?
No, I think you're allowed to look back 2 weeks. You're probably allowed to look further than that back. But I think the question is, somebody arguably could never have been before in a police interview before. Someone could be in multiple times. But even if you've been in multiple times, it doesn't necessarily mean that you automatically remember everything. So there should be some additional indicia of reasonableness and reliability that you can rely on doing the totality. And the officers were clear. And I'm not trying to overstate this. They did absolutely nothing to determine it. Even though the trial judge asked the questions that you're now going to at the time of the hearing as to what his education was, what his other life experiences were, the officer that was questioning him that day, who was the second officer, not the officer that read him the rights the week before, did not know my client. He had not had prior contact with my client. He did absolutely nothing to ask him whether he had been drinking. He didn't have any prior experiences with my client. And so that officer, in his reasonableness as an investigating officer, I believe he had an obligation to understand that my client understood his Miranda rights and that he was waiving them. And that officer did nothing. He acknowledged on the transcript he did absolutely nothing.
So would you say that every officer who is involved with a defendant throughout a period of time, an interrogation should Mirandize the individual with every different officer that comes before or deals with them?
No, I don't believe Officer Sinclair had an obligation to re-Mirandize. The way the testimony of the transcripts indicated was that Officer T.J. Wolf testified that he, in fact, did Mirandize, and Officer Sinclair said that prior to questioning my client, he confirmed with Officer Wolf that, in fact, the Mirandas had been given. So I am not asserting that Officer Sinclair had an obligation to re-Mirandize, but I am asserting that he had an obligation to make sure that my client understood that the Miranda rights and that he waived it. And he was clear that he never bothered to ask Mr. Wolf whether or not.
So you'd like the rule to be that when there's multiple officers involved, they have to check with one another to ascertain, number one, did you Mirandize him, and are you sure he understood it?
One of them, I believe, Your Honor, has to do that. And in this case, none of them didn't.
So if the first one ascertains he understood it, but the second one doesn't confirm that, is he derelict in duty?
I believe that someone has to do it. And if I'm an officer and I wasn't present when the other officer did it, am I not? How do I know that Mirandas were even given and that the waiver occurred if I don't communicate with another officer? Because I would have to assume at that point in time that he needs to be Mirandized.
But you're saying he only needs to be Mirandized once, and that has to be, and at that particular Miranda experience, the officer that is doing the Mirandizing has the ability to take the totality of the circumstances into consideration when determining whether the defendant understands his waiver.
No, the trial court has the obligation of determining the totality of the circumstances, but to help the trial court in making that decision, the officer has to have some evidence to give the trial court to make that decision. And I am suggesting in this case it was devoid of any evidence. I am suggesting that my client's case, in this case, Mr. Lather's case, is similar to Tagg versus Louisiana. I don't believe there's a difference. In that case, the officer read from a card, but he couldn't on his own recite what the Miranda rights were. Okay, in this case, that's not an issue. He couldn't recall whether or not my client understood, or excuse me, in Tagg, he couldn't recall whether or not the defendant understood the rights that were read to him. In this case, there was no attempt. So I believe it's verbatim at that point in time. And further, the officer could not say yes or no whether he had done any kind of testing or independent verification that the defendant was waiving. Ditto. I believe this case is real easy if we're going to use constitutional law. I believe Tagg versus Louisiana is the case at point, and this court doesn't have to make any new law.
The statement at issue in this case came from Detective St. Clair, who said, what's this scale used for? And the answer was, a prior renter left it here and it doesn't work. And that statement was later used in trial, and it was admitted in trial.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's interesting to understand the procedural aspects of this case. There were two trials in this case before it reached the Court of Appeals. There was a hung jury trial, lasted 3 days, the same jury heard that evidence, and then there was a second trial where the same jury, or a subsequent jury heard it, and obviously there was a conviction.
You really want is a new trial without that statement being admitted. Is that an incriminating statement or an exculpatory statement in your view?
Well,
it's not mine. It was left by a prior renter and it doesn't work.
I guess I'd put it in this perspective. There was two separate questions. He found one scale. What's the purpose? The officer's version was the defendant said it was left by the prior tenants. The officer then finds two more scales.
Yes.
Officer now goes back with a second question. What about these scales? The defendant allegedly says they're the prior tenants and they don't work. So now we got three scales and supposedly the defendant knows that they don't work. So I believe that a jury would find that to be incriminating. I believe it is an incriminating statement at that point in time. So I believe it should be withheld. The Court of Appeals said that it should be withheld using a totality of the circumstances. And I would further note there were five other issues before the Court of Appeals that have not been resolved because they held them moot because they thought this issue was so significant, and they also said that when they looked at the rest of the transcript and all the evidence, the alleged guilt of the defendant was not overwhelming, and they felt that he should get a new trial. And I believe that this court was improperly misled in the motions for jurisdiction that were filed, and I would ask the court to consider dismissing this case as being improvidently allowed.
Thank you, Mr. Sandwich.
Thank you.
Mr. Colasar, Mr. Crawford, you've saved a minute and 40 seconds of your total time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first like to address Mr. Sandwich's characterization that this would be the first case decided anywhere that allows just both an implicit understanding and implicit waiver. There were three cases at least that I cited in my brief. State versus Hamilton, United States versus Hayes, which is a Fourth Circuit federal decision, United States versus Rubio, which is a Second Circuit. Those are all cited, and I believe I cited them in both briefs. I would also like to address some of the questions that were asked regarding the findings at the trial court level. Implicit in the trial court's finding that there was a valid waiver on the 17th is that the defendant at that time knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his rights. And those facts, those are findings of facts, must also be considered when you're looking at the 31st. The factors that he had prior contact with law enforcement, three times with this officer where he was arrested, at his educational background, which was a high school diploma, some college, all these things that are standard circumstances that should be considered to see if he has an actual understanding. Then on the 31st, he comes back with this, he's the same person, he comes back with that same level. He's educated, he's still the same age, it's 2 weeks later, and those things all remain. Yet now he has an additional contact with law enforcement on top of that on the 17th, where he actually did waive his rights. To ignore all that and set aside his waiver on the 31st is internally inconsistent. It does not, the Sixth District's decision does not adequately take into consideration the facts that it found itself. I see that my time has expired, and we would ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colasar. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.